of the United States government.
This is VOA News. I'm Richard Green. Israel bombed at least three homes in Rafah overnight Wednesday, raising new fears among the more than million people sheltering in the southern city that a long-threatened ground assault could be on its way. Reuters correspondent Olivia Chan has more.
Displaced Gazan and Jamil Abu Houri said the intensification of airstrikes was Israel's way of showing its disdain for a UN Security Council resolution last week, demanding an immediate ceasefire. He fears next stop would be a ground assault on Rafah, which Israel has threatened to carry out, despite pleas from its closest ally, Washington, that this would cause too much harm to civilians. Look at our little ones. Look at our children. Where should we go? Abu Houri said.
That was Reuters correspondent Olivia Chan. An Israeli airstrike on a paramedic center linked to a Lebanese Sunni Muslim group in South Lebanon killed seven of its members early Wednesday. The airstrike hit an office of the Islamic Emergency and Relief Corps overnight. That's according to the Lebanese Ambulance Association. The strike was one of the deadliest single attacks since violence erupted along the Lebanon-Israel border more than 5 months ago. The militant Hezbollah group vowed to avenge the attack, saying it will not pass without punishment. Nearly 500 immigration and human rights organizations signed a letter Wednesday urging the U.S. government to halt deportations of Haitians and expand migrant protections. The San Diego-based Haitian Bridge Alliance joined 481 migration, human rights, religious, and civil rights groups calling for the administration of President Joe Biden to extend temporary protected status for Haitians, halt deportations and forced returns, release detained migrants, and expand parole programs for refugees. This is VOA News. Countries including the United States, Canada, and France have been evacuating their citizens amid growing gang violence on the Caribbean island nation. The letter said if the U.S. cannot keep its personnel safe in Haiti, then the Haitian government is unlikely to keep Haitian nationals safe. The UN estimates over 360,000 Haitians have been internally displaced and thousands have been killed in the conflict, which has also cut off access to health care, food, and regular income. U.S. safety officials said Wednesday the pilot of the cargo freighter that crashed into a highway bridge in the eastern U.S. city of Baltimore, Maryland, had reported a loss of power minutes before the disaster, citing audio from the ship's data recorder. Meanwhile, the U.S. Coast Guard said the vessel's engines had undergone routine maintenance in port before the crash. Here's AP correspondent Sagar Magani with the details.
Rear Admiral Shannon Gilreath says authorities were told the Dolly was going to have routine maintenance.
We were not informed of any problems with the vessel,
which ended up losing power before it crashed into the bridge. The disclosure came as divers recovered the bodies of two of the six construction workers who were fixing potholes on the bridge and plunged into the Patapsco River.
The deceased were removed from the vehicle and brought to the shore.
Maryland State Police head Roland Butler says the other four workers are presumed dead, and once the water is clear of the bridge's debris,
those same divers are going to go back out there and bring those people closure.
Sagar Magani, Washington.
A U.S. appeals court has maintained a hold on a law passed in the southwestern state of Texas that will let state authorities arrest and prosecute people suspected of illegally crossing the U.S.-Mexican border. Reuters correspondent Zachary Gelman reports.
The law would make it a state crime to illegally enter or re-enter Texas from a foreign country and would empower state judges to order that violators leave the United States, with prison sentences up to 20 years for those who refuse to comply. The Republican-backed law met immediate legal pushback from Democratic President Joe Biden's administration. The White House says the law oversteps the authority of the federal government to enforce immigration laws.
That was Reuters correspondent Zachary Gelman. U.S. Treasury Secretary Janet Yellen said Wednesday that a surge in cheap exports from China in industries like electric vehicles could create an oversupply and hurt economies. Secretary Yellen says she plans to raise those risks during the next trip to China sometime this year and press Beijing to take necessary steps to address this issue. She also raised concerns about the impact that China's excess industrial capacity could have on other countries. I'm Richard Green for VOA News.
morning, Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Barty, Washington. Today is Thursday, March 28th, and here are some of the stories we are covering. The latest provisional results in Senegal's election show opposition candidate Diomaye Faye with an insurmountable lead.
If you combine the result of Diomaye Faye and the result of Amadou Ba, you already have almost 90% of the vote. So it means that people wanted to get rid of a president.
South Africa's ruling ANC files a new court application to stop the opposition MK from using its name. Officials say it's too soon to know the economic impact from the collapse of a key bridge in Baltimore, Maryland. South Sudan says it will reopen schools on April 2nd. A petition is calling for a global convention on crimes against humanity.
While there is a convention on genocide and also the Geneva Conventions on war crimes, there has never been an actual convention on crimes against humanity to ensure the prevention and punishment of those crimes.
And a Malawi charity provides hope for elderly citizens, including those accused of being witches. Those stories and more are coming up on Daybreak Africa. Bassirou Diomaye Faye has won Senegal's presidential election with 54% of the votes, according to provisional results, while his main rival, Amadou Ba, trailed with about 35%. VOA's Nairobi Bureau Chief Mariama Diallo is in Dakar and has this report.
Provisional results show that opposition candidate Bassirou Diomaye Faye won by a comfortable margin, while his main rival, Amadou Ba, came in second, Dakar's Court of Appeals said on Wednesday. Amadi Diouf, who leads the National Vote Counting Commission, read the results.
Amadou Ba, 1,605,086 voix.
He said Amadou Ba had 1,605,086 votes, meaning 35.79%, and Bassirou Diomaye Diakhare Faye had 2,434,751 votes, meaning 54.28%. Diouf said that about 61% of 7.4 million registered voters cast their ballots. The results are expected to be confirmed by the Constitutional Council no later than Friday. But the ruling coalition's candidate, who had already conceded, congratulated his opponent earlier this week. In his first public address on Monday, the president-elect vowed to fight corruption, rebuild institutions, and reconcile the country. His victory in Sunday's elections followed a political crisis sparked by outgoing President Macky Sall's failed attempt to postpone the vote. Mariama Diallo, VOA News, Dakar, Senegal.
Senegalese opposition candidate Bassirou Diomaye Faye is on the verge of being declared winner of the March 24 presidential election. The latest provisional results from 100% of polling stations show Faye has won 54.28% of the votes. His nearest competitor, Amadou Ba, received 35.79% of the votes. Senegalese political analyst Ibrahim Makan tells me the results are a referendum on President Macky Sall, who, he says, did everything to almost derail the elections.
The situation today is that finally we have all the results, the provisional results, collected by the judiciary, because here in Senegal, it's the judiciary that compiled all the results. And the announcement is made by the president of the Court of Appeal of Dakar. Once the statement is read by the president of the Court of Appeal, now he is transmitting all the file to the Constitutional Court tomorrow. And from tomorrow, the Constitutional Court gives 3 days to any candidate who eventually has a complaint or who is not satisfied by the provisional result to make a complaint, so that after 3 days, it can look at all the complaints and make the final decision.
So although these are provisional, but looking at the figures, you would say that Bassirou Diomaye Faye is winning or won convincingly.
Yes, 54% of the total vote and winning at the first round. That's, I think, for somebody who is a candidate for the first time, I think it's a very important result. But one of the things that it confirmed, the idea that we had in the past, that this election was more a referendum than an election. Because if you combine the result of John Maifei and the result of Amadou Ba, you already have almost 90% of the vote. So it means that people wanted to get rid of a regime, to get rid of a president who really did everything to make sure that the election will not take place. So this is the reaction of the population.
So while we wait for the Constitutional Court to make the final announcement, is there any movement on the part of the new leader in terms of who he might be to be in his government?
Well, in the media, there are speculation, but I think before that, what needs to be really sorted out immediately is the handover of power. Now, we all know that Macky Sall is leaving on the 2nd of April. And I think now, given the fact that the Constitutional Council has 3 days until 31st of March, now, the 1st of April, he will make the final decision about the election. And the second, the handover of power will be done because the president has to sworn in before the Constitutional Court and then go to the presidential palace, get the keys of the official residence of the president, and so that Macky Sall also can just go back to his house. That is how the handover. Then after, maybe on the 3rd, the president will designate a prime minister and give that prime minister a number of days to propose to the president a list of ministers, and if the president approves, that will be the first government of John Maifei. So I think next week will be dedicated to that.
Before I let you go, is it possible we could see or we might see Ousmane Sonko in the new government?
So far, I have to confess, Ousmane Sonko is showing very low profile. And I think that's good for him because the person who was elected is John Maifei, not Ousmane Sonko. Even if Ousmane Sonko is the most popular politician, but it's John Maifei who is elected. In my view, Sonko will not have a position in the executive. Probably because you know that probably in September we will have a new parliament. This parliament will be dissolved because the majority of the parliament is not in favor of Ousmane Sonko and his party. And at that time, probably if Ousmane Sonko is elected member of the parliament, he can be a speaker. And I think that will be a perfect complementarity between Ousmane Sonko and John Maifei. John Maifei controlling the executive, Sonko controlling the parliament, so that they can work very smoothly.
Ibrahim Makan is a Senegalese political analyst. He was speaking with us from the capital, Dakar. South Africa's ruling party on Wednesday filed a new court application to stop the opposition MK party, backed by ex-president Jacob Zuma, from using its name. The African National Congress said the Umkhonto Wesizwe name and logo are similar to those of the now disbanded apartheid-era military wing of the ANC, and that this could deceive or confuse voters. According to the French news agency AFP, the court battle is the latest move amid political tensions in the Southern African country, which is headed for general elections on May 29. Filani Majozi is an author and macroeconomic and political analyst. He tells viewers Douglas Mpuga that it seems the ANC is nervous about what appears to be a major rival.
To basically highlight the tensions within the ANC and the fact that the ANC is very much concerned and nervous. Hence, they've went to court to try and challenge what seems to be becoming a major rival to them as they head to the election. So the ANC is using all kinds of means possible, of course, within the legal framework, that this MK party does not really gain ground because it's a very big threat to the ANC's power, to the ANC's governance, to the ANC's, you know, election campaign, and ANC's chances to win the election. So the ANC, in a sense, it's lost something big, and they're nervous, and they will struggle to really control or suppress the MK party heading to the election.
MK party has a full backing of the former president, Jacob Zuma, who seems to be popular, especially in his region. How do you think MK will perform itself in these elections?
Well, MK, the polls show it doing very well that have been done. I think there is at least two polls, if I'm not mistaken, that show that it will really be a party that does very well, given that it's brand new. And it really owes its performance to Jacob Zuma. You know, Jacob Zuma is very popular in his region, KwaZulu-Natal, huge following. In fact, the ANC, post-1994, after democracy came in South Africa, the ANC for the first at least about close to 15 years or so, it was not ruling KwaZulu-Natal, right? KwaZulu-Natal was being ruled by a different party. And then Zuma came into power to lead the ANC. And then KZN of KwaZulu-Natal swapped into Jacob Zuma's following. They became the ANC. And Zuma was instrumental in making that happen. It's Jacob Zuma who moved KwaZulu-Natal from the Inkatha Freedom Party that had ruled since 1994 and moved the province to the ANC, right, because of Jacob Zuma. A very traditionalist man, very much relates to the people, a man of culture, Zulu culture, very proud Zulu. So he has that, really that huge following, and people relate to him in KwaZulu-Natal. He knows the language very well. So he's really going to be, especially in KwaZulu-Natal and Gauteng, where there are also many Zulu people who live in Gauteng. So Zuma will make gains both in KwaZulu-Natal, with his MK party both in KwaZulu-Natal and Gauteng as well. But most importantly, KwaZulu-Natal, because that is where really he's got momentum and is going to hurt the ANC.
Fumlani Majozi is an author and a macroeconomic and political analyst. He spoke from Johannesburg with viewers Douglas Mpuga. You are listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Barton, Washington. Today is Thursday, March 28th. For more Africa news and features, visit our website at voaafrica.com. Connect with us on all social media platforms. We are on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. Three 105 human rights organizations and individuals have signed a petition calling for a global convention on crimes against humanity. They want countries to use this year's 79th session of the UN General Assembly to move the draft articles on prevention and punishment of crimes against humanity forward. Elise Kepler is executive director of the Global Justice Center, which works to advance gender equality using international law. She tells me a treaty on crimes against humanity would close the gap in the current international framework on mass atrocities, as well as clarifying the duties of states to prevent such crimes.
So for several years now, there have been something called the draft articles on the prevention and punishment of crimes against humanity. And those are being looked at by the Sixth Committee of the United Nations with the hope that they can move to formal negotiations to establish a crimes against humanity treaty. Now, not everyone is aware of this, but while there is a convention on genocide and also the Geneva Conventions on war crimes, there has never been an actual convention on crimes against humanity, which is a major gap in international law to ensure the prevention and punishment of those crimes. This effort seeks to address that gap so that there are more tools to ensure that there is accountability for crimes against humanity and to encourage against their commission. And as part of this process, civil society from around the world, more than 300 civil society groups and leading human rights experts have today issued a statement calling for governments over the coming months to show support for these articles to be formally negotiated into a crimes against humanity treaty. And I think it's really significant that we see groups have come on board from across Africa, from Asia, from the Middle East, to signal they want to see governments stand up for prevention and punishment of crimes against humanity and are looking to governments to show their support for this to enter into formal negotiations for a treaty.
But Elise, there's the International Criminal Court. There are other international bodies that deal with crimes against humanity.
Yep.
What's the difference here?
Great question. So the International Criminal Court is dealing with criminal prosecutions, individual criminal responsibility for genocide, war crimes, and crimes against humanity. That is one tool. It's an essential tool in the arsenal of tools to combat against these crimes. But this treaty, if it is to be negotiated into a treaty, will allow for a broader recognition of the criminality of crimes against humanity and impose, create, expressly provide an obligation on states to prevent and punish these crimes. So it really expands the tools in the toolbox to ensure that these crimes are not tolerated around the world.
Elise Kepler is Executive Director of the Global Justice Center. She was speaking with us from Paris, France. South Sudan authorities say they will reopen schools on April 2nd after closing for nearly a week due to the serious health hazard to students posed by extreme heat. Health Minister Yolanda Awil-Deng tells me the country has never witnessed such temperatures as high as 113 degrees Fahrenheit.
The heat wave that forced us as a government to close the school has been one of the heat waves that we have never experienced in South Sudan, at least in the recent history that we are aware of. It was in the higher 40s, and then in some regions for about maybe 30 minutes to 1 hour. It was in early 50s, like 51, 52 in some region of the country. So it was extreme heat and also coupled with extreme humidity. And when you combine extreme heat and extreme humidity, we have got results of heat exhaustion and like a heat stroke, especially in a vulnerable population, like children under 5, elderly, pregnant women, and people with underlying health conditions. So it was extreme heat.
In all, Minister, how many students do you think were impacted by the decision to stay at home?
Right now, I don't have data off of my fingertips. I have to consult with my technical team. But the shutdown of the school was for the whole country, like the private schools, the public school, the faith-based school, every single school, especially primary and secondary school, like they were all shut down. And when we gave advice for higher education, which is mainly adults, to make sure they abstain from the physical activities during heat hours. They had their physical activity early in the morning and late in the evening. So it was the whole countrywide decision.
Does this impact the curriculum of the school year? In other words, does it extend the school year?
It might not, because we might have some ways of trying to actually catch up. If we can make it up by giving double work or maybe extend it. At this moment, I cannot speak on that because it is in the docket of the Ministry of Education. But the lives of our students and the life and protecting South Sudanese population is my number one priority in regard to health. So like that what led us to make sure that we had got that 1 or 2 weeks shutdown of schools.
Minister, it's a pleasure to speak with you on Daybreak Africa. Thank you so much.
Appreciate it, James. Thanks.
Yolanda Awil-Deng is South Sudan's health minister. She was speaking with us from the South Sudan capital, Juba. With at least 6 people presumed to have died after a cargo ship leaving the port of Baltimore accidentally destroyed the Francis Scott Key Bridge, a rescue operation shifted to search and recovery on Wednesday. VOA's chief national correspondent Steve Herman in Washington reports the disaster will have ramifications beyond the U.S. East Coast.
Transportation Secretary Pete Buttigieg, speaking to reporters at the White House on Wednesday, said the span of Baltimore's Francis Scott Key Bridge crumpled due to the impact of a force similar to that of a big aircraft carrier ramming into it.
The impact of this collision we're talking about is not just as big as a building, it's really as big as a block. 100,000 tons all going into this pier all at once.
Officials say it is too early to know when the debris of the bridge can be removed from the Patapsco River and when the Port of Baltimore will return to normal operations. A U.S. federal supply chain task force is meeting to assess the bridge collapse and port's closure, according to Treasury Secretary Janet Yellen. Transportation Secretary Buttigieg says while it is too soon to know precisely the impact on the U.S. economy, it will not be trivial. Steve Herman, VOA News, Washington.
In Malawi, hope has arrived for elderly people banished from their homes, some over accusation of practicing witchcraft. A charity in the capital is providing shelter and food for those elderly people. Lamek Masina reports from Lilongwe.
24-year-old Deborah Mbari runs Mai Mbambande Elderly Home in a rural area of Malawi's capital, Lilongwe, hosting 85 elderly people, many from surrounding areas. They include 35 men and 50 women between the ages of 70 and 100.
We provide food for them. We clothe them. We give them basic needs that are needed in the life of an elderly person. And also, we take care of their medical bills.
The elderly people here take part in various activities to keep themselves physically fit and try to live life free from worries. Mbali started the foundation in 2020 as a social media platform, interviewing successful women and posting the interviews on Facebook. However, Mbali changed focus in 2022 after noticing the suffering elderly people in Malawi go through.
Elderly people are abused every day. They are stoned, they are killed, some they are burnt because of accusations of witchcraft.
Various local media here have long reported incidents of mob attacks and killings of elderly people suspected of practicing witchcraft. Government statistics show that witchcraft-related attacks and killings targeting elderly persons went up from 21 cases in 2022 to 29 last year. Among the targets was 89-year-old Biniwe Uchabwira, whose children and relatives attacked him last year for allegedly having a hand in the death of his grandson. He says when he tried to run away, some people grabbed him by arms and legs, while others were beating him up on his head. He says he was severely bruised. One of his children, he says, produced a machete to cut his throat. Chabwera was rescued by members of the community policing in his village. They took him to nearby police station, where he was kept for 2 weeks before the Mai Mbambande charity offered to accommodate him. He says he is very happy and comfortable here and that food is available. He says that without Mai Mbambande, he could have died by now with hunger. And if he was home, he says people would have killed him over baseless accusations. Besides providing food, the charity has constructed a house for neglected elderly people lacking decent houses, like Nastima Chikadwara, who is 81 years of age. She says she's now sleeping on a mattress after the charity built her house powered by solar electricity. Chikadwala says she's proud now, but the only problem she faces is lack of food. The charity, however, also welcomes elderly people who stay in their homes but come by to eat breakfast and lunch at the institution. In the meantime, the charity is planning a fundraising dinner on May 31 to raise money for the comfort and happiness of the neglected elderly females. Lamek Masina, VOA News, Lilongwe, Malawi.
And that's it for this Thursday, March 28th edition of Daybreak Africa. We thank you for being our guest this morning. For more Africa news and features, visit our website at voaafrica.com. Connect with us on all social media platforms. We are on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. We are also on YouTube, where you can watch our TV shows Africa 54, Straight Talk Africa, and Red Carpet. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa crew, I am James Button, Washington, saying, have a great day, and please be safe, whatever you do.